Right near the very top of the Great Barrier Reef, just near the entrance of the Torres Strait, there's a shipwreck. The ship is HMS Pandora. And Pandora's been lying there for more than 220 years. It's a beautiful, eerie thing to see on the seabed, like something from an old ghost story. When the wreck of the Pandora was discovered, it still had so many of the bits and pieces that belonged to the captain and the crew in the 1790s, and a few skeletons too. Peter Gessner is an historian and a maritime archaeologist who's directed 6 major expeditions to the wreck of the Pandora, and he knows the whole horrible story of how it came to be there and how the crew survived being stranded on the reef in the middle of nowhere. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
What kind of ship is the Pandora?
Pandora's a warship of the late 18th century, a Porcupine-class frigate. There were about 20 of the same type of vessel built, and Pandora was selected by the Admiralty to go out into the South Pacific and capture the mutineers, the people who had taken the bounty from her captain, or Captain Bligh.
Is it like those ships we've seen in, you know, Master and Commander?
Exactly like those ships. Master and Commander, the movie we saw with Russell Crowe, the scenes, they were all set sort of 20 years later. But it was very similar to the Pandora.
Yeah. Was it lined with cannons on either side of it?
That's right. So they could have broader sides. It was the smallest type of warship that there was. She was carrying 24 guns, as they called it.
Given that she came to grief on the reef, the very topmost part of the Great Barrier Reef, how far underwater is she?
Well, somewhere between 32 and 36 metres, depending on the state of the tide.
Oh, not deep at all then, really? No.
Well, it's pretty deep for human beings. it's just sort of on the border of being technologically quite complicated.
Right, so I can't get down there with a snorkel, in other words, can I?
No. Well, some people can, but you'd have to be very good.
Tell me what it was like to go on that first dive.
Well, when you see a shipwreck, it doesn't normally look like a shipwreck unless it's an iron vessel. In the Pandora's case, it had broken up quite significantly and got buried by moving sand, shifting sands. So the image of the sails with the skeleton draped over the steering wheel.
Not quite right.
Sharks swimming through but it was still tremendously exciting, of course, because, you know.
Well, what does it look like when you sort of penetrate the gloom that far down?
Well, you actually can see it from the surface on a good day, and then you know what to look for. There's sort of regular bits and pieces sort of sticking out of the sand, and you just immediately thought just how exciting it was to be, you know, one of the first people who were actually going to disturb what was there that had been lying there quite peacefully for 200 odd years.
Is it lying on its side?
It's lying on its starboard side with an angle of about 35 degrees off vertical, and because it's on its starboard side, there's more of the starboard preserved. So what you've got to try and picture is this hull lying there on its starboard side, and there's two processes that are actually happening. There's deterioration from the top down, so everything that's poking up, the masts and the rigging, they went first, and then gradually as you deteriorate, as you come down at levels into the vessel, there's burial from the bottom up. So where those two processes meet, the deterioration from top down to from bottom up, then that's where it reaches a sort of equilibrium, and that's where she is today. So, but there's about 30-odd% of the actual hull buried there in very good order.
So what's it like then to swim up to this thing and, I don't know, sweep aside some of the stuff, the silt that's on top of it, and just see the timbers underneath?
Then you see, as you're doing that with what we call a water dredge, which is like an underwater vacuum cleaner, you're sort of gently trying to sort of, exactly as you say, sweep with your hand, suck it away and deposit it somewhere where you don't need the spoil. And then gradually things sort of materialize, small things that have been lost there, a box with a bottle. That was the first thing we really saw, was a box which had gin bottles in it. There they were. The gin bottles had been put away by whoever had that particular case of gin. It's magical.
Were gin still in them?
No, the gin had somehow perished. But it is known, we have found containers with their original contents still in it.
Is it like one of those things, you know, on land, you know, soldiers would come upon a farmhouse after battle had broken out and everyone just had to run and leave? Is it a bit like that?
It's exactly like that. I mean, we call it sort of like a marine Pompeii, you know, after the volcanic outburst, all the ash layer, the dust settled and Pompeii got buried under layers and layers of this stuff. And the same thing happened with the Pandora. Everything was working and going, humming along at its normal pace. And then all of a sudden, you know, everybody's called on deck. A lot of guys would have turned in, they would have been asleep. So everybody's piped onto deck and called up, and everybody has to help to stop the ship sinking. And they leave what they're doing, the kettle still boiling or something like that.
Is that poignant? Or, I don't know, is it too much going on for you to kind of feel anything about what you're seeing?
Well, my first feeling really was about that you're diving where somebody's or a number of people have died. I mean, we knew exactly how many people had died there. 35 to be precise, 31 crew and 4 of the prisoners. You have this feeling of reverence in a way because they struggled and they lost, and you feel sorry for them, of course. But you also have this tremendously exciting feeling about being sort of the first person to see something that sort of got buried 200 odd years ago.
The story of the Pandora begins, like you say, with the mutiny on the Bounty. A really famous story. It's been turned into however many Hollywood movies.
Yep.
The Bounty is a ship. It's been captained by Captain Bligh, who's later to become governor of New South Wales, of course.
He did. Had another mutiny.
And another mutiny there with the Rum Rebellion. Yeah, that's right. He seemed to attract them, didn't he? And there's a mutiny led by Fletcher Christian, one of the men on board. And Bligh and his officers are put into a boat and pushed off, and they sail off. Hopefully they're going to hit Timor at some point. What did the crew do, led by Fletcher Christian, once they'd gotten control of the Bounty and kicked out Bligh and his men?
Well, according to the sources, they said, huzzah for Tahiti, and we're going back there. Back to where they had been a couple of weeks previously and had been actually staying there for up to 6 months. Lots of them, red-blooded British sailors, had relationships with the local women. Some had fathered children, or they had pregnant girlfriends. And they wanted to go back, because life in Tahiti compared to the life in the UK is somewhat different.
Then Fletcher Christian left and set up his own colony in Pitcairn Island for a while, didn't he?
That's right.
But a bunch of them had stayed, were still in Tahiti. That's right. What was the Royal Navy's response once they heard that there'd been a mutiny on the Bounty?
Well, they took a very dim view of it. They just couldn't have that kind of indiscipline happening. The Pandora was got ready for her voyage. They had to go and round these guys up.
So the Pandora then set out from England.
Yep.
How did it make its way to Australia?
It took the Cape Horn route, so it went diagonally across the North Atlantic into Brazil. Landed in Rio de Janeiro, came down the coast of Patagonia, went round Cape Horn and got into the Pacific that way. That was the shortest, fastest route to get to Tahiti.
Did they find the mutineers there?
They found 14 of them, the ones who had sort of disaffected the sort of return to Tahiti and not joined Fletcher Christian in Pitcairn Island.
And they were they ready to give up and go aboard the Pandora?
Some of them were more than willing to give up. In fact, some of them thought that they actually were not guilty, and they were so pleased that one of His Majesty's ships turned up that they just said, "Here I am, hello, please take me home." And then they had to round up the other people who did sort of flee and tried to hide in the mountains and sit it out. But the law was there, and they got them.
They never found Fletcher Christian and his mates to die.
No, never found him until 18 years later, approximately. He just sailed off into the blue, and he bumped into, quite literally, Pitcairn Island. But no, he was never found. He died. He never returned to England, let's put it that way.
So the captain, Pandora, then has got these prisoners. What? How many of them?
14.
14 prisoners.
Yep.
It's a crowded ship. So where did he put them?
He put them in a special prison cell, which the carpenters built on the quarter deck. That's the deck at the back. And he built this cell, which the prisoners themselves called it Pandora's Box. And it was a small cramped cell, not much bigger than this studio. I think it was about 11 feet on the deck by 18 feet and about 5 feet high, so nobody could stand up straight. So they were held in this prison cell for 4.5, nearly 5 months.
What were they doing around the Great Barrier Reef then?
Well, they were heading home by this time. And again, he was following the instructions because he was told by the Admiralty to better survey the strait that Cook had taken 20 years before that, just to see if there was a good passage through the Great Barrier Reef up in those latitudes.
Right up near the Torres Strait.
Yep.
So tell me how the Pandora came to grief on the Great Barrier Reef.
Well, the barrier reef was truly a barrier. I mean, it's very hard to get through there, especially in a sailing vessel. They actually saw a very good opening, and so one of the lieutenants went with about six or seven men in one of the boats and came back later that afternoon signalling that they'd found this good, suitable passage. So they were they had been told to come back on board, and the Pandora sort of was not under sail. It was sort of half, it was hove to, as it's called. Edwards was being very careful and was just unlucky to get pushed onto one of these little reef outcrops.
How was he pushed on? What do you mean by
the
surf?
Current. By the current, yeah. He was unlucky to crunch onto that reef at low tide.
So, Peter, how quickly then does a ship like the Pandora fill up with water and become uninhabitable?
Well, in this case, it was 2.5 hours. It was all hands to the pumps, bailing at the hatches and all hands to the pumps. So they were pumping away, pumping away. After an hour, there was 8 feet of water in the hold. So the hold was about a third full already.
So can you actually repair a hole in the hull
in
that situation? What, carpenters can go down there with hammer and
nails? Carpenters go down there with wood and boards and hammers and try and make makeshift repairs, because what would have happened was a lot of the planking, the board would have sprung, because they're constantly on a sort of a curve. So they're under pressure, and if something happens on the outside, a big enough bang like a collision with the reef, then they spring, and the water just flows in. And then at certain points during the night, we know this because we have eyewitness accounts. The surgeon, he sort of said it was an exceeding dark, stormy night, and the pressures and the wind was howling and blah, 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 yeah. Both pumps broke down at different times, so it was just impossible. And basically by 6 a.m., Edwards had a confab with all his officers, and they all agreed that there was nothing that could be done to save the ship. And they cut everything loose, and he gave the order to abandon ship, and everyone jumped overboard.
Jumped overboard into what? And onto what?
Onto nothing. Into
the water?
Into the water, yeah.
Where did they go once they were all in the water?
Well, they'd put a lot of the ship's boats out. They were sort of rowing around, picking up men. A lot of the guys couldn't swim. 31 of them drowned, plus 4 of the mutineers.
Once they'd picked up everyone in the boats, where did they go then?
They went to the Sand Cay, which they called Escape Cay, because they had escaped to it.
And what is that?
It's a tiny sand island. There's not a skerrick of vegetation on it, but it's just this big deposit of sand.
How big is this
tiny
Sandy Cay?
It's, I think, about 40 metres long by about 22 metres wide. It's just bone dry, except for the seawater.
What then? What did they do once they'd made their way there, Peter?
Well, they made a tally, an inventory of what they actually had managed to save in terms of useful things like water and something to eat. They tried to go back to the ship the next morning to see if there was anything else that might be useful for them. What they found on that second day was the ship's cat that was sitting peacefully, calmly, as cats do, above the turbulent waves that were sort of breaking around the tip of the mast. They saved the ship's cat, poor thing. Anyway,
how did they shelter themselves from that blazing heat?
Well, they thankfully had a lot of old sailcloth, or the sails that belonged to the boats, and they rigged up shelters. But for some reason, the prisoners who had escaped, there were 10 of them who had survived, they asked for an old piece of sailcloth, and they weren't allowed to have it. So they actually had to bury themselves in the sand up to their necks. And I wouldn't envy them. Some of them were naked. Some of them just had a pair of dungarees or something on. And so it was pretty hellish for them. And then they divvied up the water. The captain decided, you know, we've only got so much water. You'll each get 2 glasses a day. And that's what they did. And they prepared the boats for the survival journey to the closest place where there was European civilization. And that happened to be Timor. They didn't want to go to Sydney. Sydney had just started 3 years before that, and they would have had to go against the prevailing southeasterly wind, so they decided it would be faster and probably safer to get through the Torres Straits and across the Arafura Sea to Timor.
So they all piled into these boats again?
Four boats.
Pushed off the Sandy Cay?
After 2 days, yep.
There were 99 of these men in these boats. How many days were they at sea?
18 in all.
18 days.
In the blazing sun, very little to drink. They each had those two glasses and then a little glass of wine and a tiny piece of ship's biscuit. Not even a full ship's biscuit.
That's your in-flight meal, isn't it?
There you are. Yeah. Almost. Nowadays. there's nowhere to go. You know, you're right in the middle of the Arafura Sea.
How far did they get? Did they make it all the way to Timor?
They made it all the way to Timor, finally, and they've eventually made it back via Cape Town to the UK.
Leaving the wreck of the Pandora behind on the Great Barrier Reef.
That's right.
And what was slowly happening over the next 200 years as it lay there undiscovered?
Well, things start decaying or deteriorating, depending on how well they've been built and what they're built made of. You have the two processes I mentioned earlier on, the decay from the top down and the burial from the bottom up. And once the burial is complete, then everything that's been buried, essentially decay and deterioration slows down. And provided nobody comes along and disturbs it, if you uncover it and you allow oxygenated water to get in there, then it starts deteriorating at a tremendous rate of knots again. The deterioration is done in 50 years instead of maybe 500 years.
A shipwreck is a moment in time, isn't
exactly.
it? It's a flash-frozen moment in time.
Exactly. That flash-frozen moment is what it's all about.
So you see, you're more likely to see then, I suppose, the whole context of someone's day-to-day life then.
That's right.
Shipwreck.
Well, by proxy, you're digging up Captain Cook and the other big explorers who are all from that sort of subculture, the Royal Navy in the late 18th century, and they all had ways of doing things. They would buy certain kind of cutlery and use certain kind of crockery and, so all these little things that reflect on their person is what I think is quite interesting.
So how was the wreck of the Pandora eventually discovered?
Well, there's a contentious question, that is. It's,
are there competing claims?
There were competing claims by a number of people. Essentially, it was two filmmakers, documentary filmmakers, who were sort of vying for the honour of finding the Pandora, because it was always known that she was there somewhere in Pandora's entrance. And somebody organized the RAAF to come along with a fly magnetometer, which is actually a submarine detection device, and got this anomaly and dropped a flare. And one of the guys got there first.
Once you and your team got to the wreck, what were you able to find from that wreck, from exploring and excavating it, that you didn't know before?
Well, I never expected to find skeletal remains. I thought they would perish almost immediately.
How many human skeletal remains did you find?
Three sets.
Do you know who they are, these three people?
We have 35 names. There could be one of those 35.
So what do you call them then?
We call them Tom, Dick and Harry. Anyhow, Tom, somebody started calling one of them Harry, and then Tom and Dick followed. I'm not sure who actually coined it.
Where did you find Tom and Dick?
Tom and Dick, we found very near the surgeon's area, and that makes sense in terms of a story the surgeon related in his memoirs. He said that during the night, this exceeding dark, stormy night that he wrote about, two men before the ship sank had been killed in accidents on board. One man was collected on the head by a falling spar that had dropped out of the mast, so a big bit of
big
timber.
Big beam of timber.
Big beam of timber hit him on the head, and that was all she wrote. And the other one was collected by a cannon that sort of came rolling around.
Oh!
That had come loose and just rolled around on the deck and crushed him against the bulkhead.
So it was like a mayhem on that night. Then.
Yeah. They were trying to save the ship and, you know, everybody had to be very careful.
And are the injuries on Tom and Dick consistent with these accounts? Like, is there a smashed-in skull? And there's
there's a missing skull. And Dick has not got a skull. So we now think, because of that, that he might be one of these two chaps.
And the other skeleton, is there evidence he's been crushed by a cannon?
Again, we haven't really looked at that kind of question yet. So we think that they would have been taken down in the interests of keeping up morale. I mean, if you're trying to save your ship from sinking, the last thing you want is two dead blokes lying around. We think that they would have both been taken down to the surgeon's cabin to be disposed of at a correct time later on.
How about Harry? Where did you find him?
Harry was very interesting because we found him in a deeper layer of the ship, indicating that he was actually in the ship at the time of sinking. He was down below. So he was either one of the men, what the carpenter's crew, or one of the sailmaker's mates who were helping with the fathering, or he was the purser's steward, which would have meant that he had a legitimate reason to be in that part of the ship when the ship struck. So assuming he was there, the ship struck, he fell over, he got donged on the head by something that fell off a shelf, or he drowned straight away in the water that came gushing in at that level of the ship, and that's where Bowler might have been. So there are all these different explanations you can try and come up with, all these scenarios just to account for their presence. But by the same token, he could have just been a very confused, scared sailor who knew that he was going to die. And he went down and helped himself to the captain's rum.
Or just, you know, put his head between his legs and waited to die. That does happen. It does happen. People get ready to die and they find themselves unable to save themselves.
Mm.
This might be a slightly silly question, Peter, but you've got you and your team of divers going down there and you're finding all kinds of eerie artifacts of something from several hundred years ago. Skeletons, dead bodies. People ever get spooked by what they find down there, what they see and hear?
Yes, I mean, it is kind of spooky. You sort of feel an empathy with these guys and you start thinking about them, and when you've got their skull there and you're looking, it's almost like a Hamlet type thing. Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well. I was going through the day's collection and I just got this spooky feeling about, like, there was someone else in there, and there wasn't. Everyone else was asleep. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, and other people have reported seeing sort of a ghost-like appearance underwater. And I asked her, what did she see? She said, I saw this young man who looked very sad and was crying. And when you just said that about some people getting prepared to die, they just sit and don't know what to do, that immediately flashed in my mind too. I mean, I'm kind of open. I'm not too skeptical, but, you know, I can sort of see both sides. You might have this sort of supernatural presence.
Does anyone have any idea how many shipwrecks there are around the coast of Australia?
Well, it depends on when you stop counting.
World War II, so.
World War II, I think in excess of 6,000.
Wow.
Yeah. In Queensland, I mean, I know about Queensland, we had 2,000 up to the end of the First World War. There were 2,000. Great Barrier Reef claimed a lot of shipping.
I'm sure you've heard the legend of the mahogany ship.
Oh, yes.
That was seen ashore in the 1920s, I think, in Victoria.
That's right.
It had mahogany boards on it, the shipwreck, that was seen on a beach or a dune somewhere.
Yep.
And the presence of mahogany indicates that it was from Portugal. Not from the Netherlands, not from England, but from Portugal, which suggests it got there a long time before the Dutch ever caught sight of Australia.
The secret discovery of Australia. There's a thesis by Kevin McIntyre. It's been going on for about 30 or 40 years, that discussion. And there's more mahogany ships, not just in Victoria. There's one at Stradbroke Island, supposedly a ship that predates Cook. There's one up somewhere in the Whitsundays. And that's also a Spanish ship. And there's the Spanish soldier who was found buried in a cave somewhere up Cape York way, wearing a cuirass studded with diamonds and gold. And
what? Really?
Oh, there's all these stories.
That's just a story?
Well, when you ask for the evidence, the compelling evidence, it's not there. There's some wonderful stories. I mean, there are really some wonderful stories about a whole colony of them sitting somewhere in Northern Territories.
Portuguese.
Dutch. Yeah. The Bush Tucker Man has a great story about its colony of missing Dutchmen. It's a fantastic story.
Thank you so much for being my guest, Peter.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.